This is episode 435 of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm joined this week by Brandon Turkus and Mike Austin, and we talk about the 2015 24 Hours of Le Mans and this week's news bites. That's all ahead on episode 435 of the Autoblog Podcast. Welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by Mike Austin.
Hello.
And
back from Le Mans.
Yep, back from Le Mans, jet lagged. Tan? Not tan?
I got a little bit of like the farmer tan.
Awesome.
Some tone to my face.
The racing fan tan. See, that just rolls off the tongue better. And also joining us is Brandon Turkus.
Hello, everybody.
So what we do the garage and then news and then questions. So we'll start with the garage. And Mike, did you drive anything back from the airport today or whenever you got back? Yo,
I drove our long-term GTI, which I drove to the airport, obviously. Well, not obviously. I drove it to the airport. And both ways, today was worse. It had no air conditioning.
Oh, nine.
Yeah, so the air conditioning stopped working, apparently, as I understand this. I might not be totally clued in. And we took it to the dealer, and they recharged it, where it then promptly lost all of its... So I actually drove back from Toronto without air conditioning, and then drove to the airport, like, 2 days later without air conditioning, and then picked it up in, like, 80-degree heat and 80% humidity with no air conditioning. And, so the dealer charged it, you know, recharged the coolant, refrigerant, sorry. And, without thinking, wait, this car has 7,000 miles on it. It probably shouldn't be losing its refrigerant. We should do a leak test.
Yeah.
So it promptly lost its refrigerant again, and it's going into the shop tomorrow. And then today I drove a Charger Scat Pack in B5 blue, which is, to take the role of Stephen Ewing, way better than the Challenger, Brandon.
Come on. I Brandon, I disagree.
It's not better than the Challenger, but that's fine.
Better than the Challenger.
I do like the Scat Pack an awful lot. Like it's a hilarious car, and I think it's the right blend of kind of Hellcat madness and crazy aesthetics and all that, and performance compared to like a normal standard SRT.
Yeah, and it has it has cloth seats, which I kind of like.
Yep. They're really nice. They're the same as the actual SRT seats, but they're just cloth instead of leather.
That sounds strangely comfortable.
They are. They're really... I like them more, personally. I mean, I reviewed the Scat Pack in, like, October of last year, and then I drove the Hellcat a couple weeks ago, and so same seats, but the cloth ones just felt better as I was driving along, I guess. I don't really can't really put my finger on why, but I just like them more.
I mean, it's a little grippier. I generally like, not always, but I like cloth a lot.
So what's the verdict on the Scat Pack Charger? Do we need to spill any or spend any time talking about that? Or is it just the Charger?
No, it's got the Super Track Pack. So it's got the apps and the buttons. It doesn't have as many settings as the Hellcat, but it does have the cool setting and the Uconnect where you can, choose what your steering and your suspension and your transmission settings are. And you can customize it a little bit. And then it has all the track pack apps in the instrument cluster, so you can do 0 to 60 in the G-Force. So it's all pretty sweet. What impressed me most, though, was I was driving home and I noticed that there's a game finder feature on the satellite radio, and you set your favorite teams, and it tells you when what channel the game is on. So I was like, oh wait, maybe the Tigers are playing today. And sure enough, it took me. I had to go into the settings, but then it took me straight to the Tigers. It was it's a fantastic feature.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's not as charming as searching up and down AM for what you're looking for, and especially where you guys are, like you could probably get a lot of French AM, which we can't get here until it's like a clear night. And then I get,
I think we really only get the French in the winter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're not quite close enough to Quebec.
I yeah. So we talked about AM on the last podcast. I'm not going to do it again this time. all right. So the GTI, they're going to maybe the refrigerant replacement, they put dye in and they'll figure out where it's leaking from. That's going to be fun. So keep us posted on that, because one of the things we always talk about is sort of the reliability and longevity of the long-term cars. So seems like an outlier. I really haven't heard of Volkswagens having AC problems, so it's probably not really anything major.
Well, and this is one where it's that overlap between reliability and dealer, right? You know, sometimes a car goes wrong, and if you just take it in and it gets fixed, then no big deal. But when you have, you know, this turns from, oh, the car had a problem, to, oh, this car is kind of a pain, because for whatever reason, whether they didn't diagnose it right, or they're just in a hurry to get it back out, or whatever, you know, they didn't fix it the first time.
Yeah, well, an AC, a lot of guys can be flummoxed by AC, so the first thing they'll do is like recharge it. But if like there's a pressure valve that actually, if the pressure in the system gets too high, it blows off and out goes the charge, and then that valve needs to be replaced, or it's going to blow off during normal operation again. So there's all kinds of stuff to AC that you, and maybe the dealership doesn't have a specialist that is as good as, you know, they used to be. So I don't know. I'm interested to find out what happens.
All right. Well, I'm sure Steve will talk about it in the next weeks.
Yeah. Well, we can't make it through a podcast without mentioning GTI. So we've done it now. It's like 9 minutes in. I think we should leave the GTI and talk about what Brandon is driving. And hopefully it's not a GTI, because I didn't look at the calendar, so I don't know what you're driving.
Yeah. In a bizarre and unusual twist, I have the best car in the fleet this week. I'm driving the 2015 Mercedes-Benz CLS 63 AMG S4MATIC.
Too many letters.
It is a very long and obnoxious name.
It's a Mercedes AMG now. It's not a Mercedes.
I'm sorry.
Okay, so it's a Mercedes. So it's AMG CLS 63
AMG. Is, do you say AMG again?
I don't think so.
I don't think so anymore.
Why can't it just be normal like it used to be? I mean, because if it were, this would be a CLS 55.
Have you noticed that the Germans are out of their minds?
Well, the most annoying thing about it is Mercedes isn't even the company's name. Mercedes is the name they adopted in like 1920 or something, with a Benz added to Benz's name.
Right, it's because it's Daimler-Benz, and it was named after Mercedes Jelinek, who was like the sales guy. So, yeah. It's the CLS 63S format?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So that's pretty fancy. I'm going to say that's like a $180,000 car.
No. Nowhere near that much.
No, I thought that was... Oh, wait. CLS. I'm sorry.
CLS, yes.
Dummy.
Yeah, because there is no more CL. It's the S-Class Coupe.
Right.
But yeah, this is the CLS 63, 5.5 liter twin turbocharged V8, 577 horsepower. It'll hit 60 in about 3.6 seconds. All wheel drive. This one, it starts at 106,550, but my particular car is 118,505, which in the grand scheme of, you know, crazy German sedans isn't a lot in terms of like optional extras. But
it better not need any options at that price.
Right, but also I'm going to take the contrary point here. You have like what is essentially a glorified E-Class coupe. I think they might even be renaming it E-Class in the new naming scheme. But it did not. Did it get all the same updates that the E-Class has had lately? And also, I don't really think the second generation CLS was that pretty. So
I think it was outstanding.
Tell me why it's the best car in the fleet.
Well, no, I'm talking the best car in like the Autoblog fleet.
Oh, okay.
Even so, like, tell us why it's the best car in the Autoblog fleet.
Because it has 577 horsepower and it's a big AMG V8.
I mean, he just had a Scat Pack Charger that has a lot of horsepower.
Yeah, but this is a lot faster. Sure. But look, stop taking the wind out of my sails here. This is
our job.
I demand you don't enjoy the fabulously expensive car you're driving.
I mean, it's not a terrible looking car. I mean,
I've always really enjoyed the way this car looks.
Yeah,
I think it's very pretty. The one that I have, and it's a very nice design on, like, in terms of the paint selection and whatnot. It's iridium silver. But then it's got these just sinister 19-inch AMG wheels. They're cross-spoke. They're black. They look outstanding. They're also $2,200, which is a bit pricey. Inside, it's carbon fiber trim with what color leather is it? Black leather.
Black.
And silver seat belts, which is just kind of, it's just a very cool car. I mean, it looks badass. It looks seriously badass.
And it sounds badass because Mercedes does that.
Well, see, here's the thing. I like everything about it, but I would like it a lot more if it were the old CLS 63 and still had that awesome V8, because it doesn't quite have the same presence, I feel like, in terms of how it sounds and how it performs. It's a really quick car, but it's not as loud, and it's not as, you know, in your face, and it just feels more, I guess, tame, even though it's more powerful.
Does it drive more tame, though, besides the sort of subdued engine sound that you've noticed?
Yeah, I think it does, because the thing is, I've driven it, I've put maybe 50 miles on it since I got it earlier today, and I don't know if it's just that I'm kind of, like, getting used to faster cars, or because I just had the Hellcat a couple weeks ago or whatever, but it didn't feel like a car that was getting to 60 in you know, 3.5 seconds.
Did it feel longer than that? I mean, that's...
Yeah, it didn't have the same kind of, like, you know, grand process to it. Like, it didn't... There was no pomp and circumstance to the way it performed, really. Huh. And that was always kind of the thing about the old AMG V8, the 6.2 liter, that always really, you know, got me going, is that it made the entire process this grand proceeding. And I don't get that with the new turbo V8 or twin turbo V8.
See, and well, I mean, I just had the S-Class Coupe not too long ago, and I thought that it definitely felt quick. And that has the twin turbo V8 too. I didn't feel like it lacked for power or speed. I felt like it was kind of a poorly integrated car. Like it felt very large and I don't want to say clumsy, but maybe that's the right word. Like nothing really gelled together. It wasn't like you sort of became one with the car, which is such a cliche, but like, I don't just, this is a slightly smaller car. It's a slightly different car. Is that still sort of the thing? Like it just doesn't feel all of a piece or not, or it feels like it's got all of the stuff, but just not.
No, finished. I mean, no, it definitely feels good. And it definitely feels like a complete, like, complete car, and you can really get into it. It's just, it's not as dramatic anymore, is kind of what I feel like. You know, that was the thing about AMGs. They were always, it was just so much drama. I mean, so much drama from the time you started up to the time you took off to, you know, the sound it makes on upshifts. And it's just like everyone, it's like this car has taken, you know, that taken the volume knob and turned it down from 11 to like a 9. Still really loud, but it doesn't go to 11.
Right, it's not Spinal Tap. There's a perfect ad campaign in there though, like the new Mercedes CLS 63 AMG. Like, you know, less dramatic. You want drama? Get a mistress. This car's easier to drive. I don't know.
You're probably buying one for your mistress. I mean, I don't think they advertise those. They sell what, like 600 a year?
Yeah, it's probably not a high volume Mercedes for them.
But you know the thing that really got to me, and I thought this as I was driving home, is I kind of just wish I were driving an M6 Grand Coupe. Mm. And you know, I've been staunchly anti M for quite a while, but it just
that just sounded funny. I'm sorry.
Like if you're gonna have bad taste, you might as well do it with style. Is that your theory?
You've yeah, been kind of.
But, yeah, I just.
I love the Grand Coupe. It's beautiful.
I love the Grand Coupe. But yeah, I haven't really been a big fan of BMW's M cars, but in against the CLS, it kind of had that drama that I'm missing.
But that's the classic dichotomy. It's like back, there was a stretch of like 5 to 7 years where Mercedes was chasing BMW, and then they were like, yeah, you know what? We're Mercedes. We make cars that are different and perhaps more sedate in some ways, and you know, BMW can have their BMW thing. Like, they dabbled, and then they decided to shift back to being more like Mercedes traditionally had been.
Well, that's like, to me, that's the S-Class coupe. Like, the large Benzes, I felt like the 63 trim has always been the worst one, because it's trying to be something that it really isn't. But, you know, like, it doesn't need to be that much quicker. But by like stiffening it up and trying to turn it a little bit sporty, you're just kind of like, I don't get the point. This, you know, if you want speed, get the V12. The idea of those cars is they go like 85 with, you know, one hand on the wheel, like staring out the side window. It's like they're basically like a jet. You know, so the AMG stuff on those doesn't really work for me.
Yeah, I can see that. I, the funny thing too is, like, in AMG trim, it like you said, it's not the best looking. Like, it's prettier as just the straight up CLS 550 or whatever.
Yeah, no, I can agree with that.
I feel like the AMG works really well on the E-Class. That's especially, I mean,
I think that's
the podcast for a bunch of journalists. Of course, the wagon.
In brown.
Now, if we were really talking about it, the CLS shooting brake, that's what I need over here.
Yeah.
Give me a CLS shooting brake AMG, and I will be a very happy man. But yeah, I mean, I've got to spend more time with it. I haven't driven this car in a very long time, and I literally got it not even 12 hours ago. So I've got a lot more driving in front of me with it, and you know, maybe my opinion will change after I, you know, get out and take it around a bit more.
I mean, it's nothing a late night run to Chicago and back can't cure. I think you should do it.
Yeah, but here's the thing: if that means going to Chicago.
Well, you're not going to stay. You're just going to sort of like loop around one on-ramp and just shoot back.
Yeah. Still means going to Chicago.
Kind of. Well, you'll put more miles on it within 24 hours. Within 24 hours, they're going to replace what I'm driving. It's German, but it's not a Mercedes. It's a 2015 Beetle convertible TDI.
Manual?
So no, DSG.
Oh, yeah.
It's a weird car because convertible and TDI, like, those are sort of the two different ends of the spectrum, and they mash up. And it's bright, bright red. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, it's not really my thing. But if you want a nicely trimmed convertible that gets 40 miles to the gallon, how many choices do you have?
Not many.
Did the creepy teacher in Better Off Dead drive? Did he drive a cabriolet or did he drive a Beetle convertible? Well, he was like,
"Oh, I gotta look at that now."
Lane, I'm wondering. Such would you mind if I asked him?
Oh, that's right. I forgot. About that. I just remember.
I know he had a Volkswagen convertible, but I was just thinking, like, Beetle diesel convertible is totally capitalizing on like the original, like people that owned original Beetles. They're like, man, I really want a Beetle, but it's not weird enough anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a car that I've kind of been like, well, I'm not a former hippie, and like, I'm not sure that I'm the right person for this car. Like, it seems like this is an alternative to a Prius with a little bit more style. It feels like that's the kind of person who's going to go after this car. But,
well, how does it drive? Does it feel slow? Is it smelly? I mean,
none of that. It's fine. The TDI, the one thing I noticed about the TDI, it's very strong, and then it runs out of breath really quick.
Right.
Because it's got a low red line, but it's got a lot of torque. So it feels plenty fine. It's got plenty of power all the time. And you know, the funny thing about the DSG is it's great like on the highway and generally once you start rolling, but it's crappy in low speed situations like parking lots and stuff. It's one of those transmissions that I still cringe about longevity. And I know that's kind of, again, it's just maybe I'm just thinking about all of those clutches and stuff and imagining problems that maybe not aren't there. But I don't really see too much advantage for this transmission over a conventional automatic. Like the Mazda automatic is pretty light and pretty efficient, and it drives better than this one. I know it's kind of an esoteric thing to go after, but I was looking around the car today. It's nice in terms of the way Volkswagen convertibles have always been nice. It's got a multi-layer top. It's pretty quiet. It's not like you miss out on any options. You know, the interior is nicely trimmed. Everything feels high quality. Design is obviously a high point. You know, the nav system is, it's Volkswagen nav, so the screen is tiny and it's weird to pair with your phone. You have to scratch your head for a minute. But, you know, it's a power top that retracts quickly. You can even do it while you're rolling, which is a plus. It's a highly stylish car that doesn't cost a ton of money. It's like $33,000 equipped this way, because this one had the sound and navigation package. So that's not a bad deal. Like, if you want the pure driving car, obviously you're going to go for something like the Miata, or if you're okay with a coupe, you're going to go for the FT86. But this is just a car to kind of bang around in and get exceptional fuel economy, and the top goes down.
Some people just want a fun convertible. They're not looking for the dedication that they think a Miata involves.
No, and my 7-year-old loved it. He was out of his mind. He was like, "Oh, I'm gonna get one of these one day." I was like, "All right, man, that's fine." Because convertibles are impressive, and it didn't even have a lot of cowl shake, which is one of the things that I really don't like about a lot of convertibles is how much they cowl shake over bumps. It's got a little bit. It's noticeable, but it's not distracting or annoying. I'm impressed with it overall. It's a solid little convertible, kind of as it's always been. It's not the manliest of the man beetles, but I like the new Beetle better than the two previous generations. I think it looks really great. And the fact that you can get the diesel in it, it's kind of an interesting twist, and it's a pleasant surprise. And I think it almost like belongs there when you consider the buyer, right? Like, it's a perfect match. It's a fun car that does return ridiculously good fuel economy. So I like it. I'm surprised with it. I'm ready for it to go. And maybe they can drop off something else that's a little bit more thrilling. But I spent a delightful week with it, with the top down. The other thing that you did this week, Mike, you were in France. France. At what is Circuit de la Sarthe?
Yes. Just outside of the actual town of Le Mans. So this is my first time there, and it's one of the automotive, it's one of the auto racing meccas. It's just like, sorry, there's a cat walking into the room.
Awesome. My cat used to be a podcast star. That's okay. Yours.
Anyway, yeah, it was amazing. It's just, this was a really interesting year, just with Porsche challenging Audi and then the new Nissan. But the circuit itself is just kind of amazing being there. It's 8 miles long, 8 miles and change. So it's one of the longest tracks remaining, and the Mulsanne Straight is crazy. It's a real road, and it's French. So they have a lot of runoff, like camber on the road. So these guys are doing like more than 200 miles an hour, and the car is moving around because the road surface isn't totally flat or consistent. And I haven't been to a race in a while. The noise is incredible. Just being at a track and hearing that, it's like you can't really describe it. And actually, my favorite part of that was the GTE class, because it was Aston, Corvette, Ferrari, and the Porsches, and each one just sounds like the craziest open pipe version of the road car. You could always tell when the Astons were going by, when the Corvettes were going by, and the Ferraris were screeching. So like the whole drama of being around the race was fantastic. And then I was there as a guest of Nissan, and they took the soccer stadium at the like north end of the track and turned it into a hotel. So we had these little literal, they were cubicles. They were like temporary buildings, temporary little rooms with a cot on them. And, you know, so there wasn't a lot of privacy. They were kind of noisy if you accidentally hit the wall, but you're right at the track. So, and you don't have to camp. So that was ideal.
And so did you ask Nissan what was up with what they were doing? Didn't they sort of have a little bit of trouble this year with their GTR?
I think generous.
They didn't expect to compete, but I don't think they expected it to go like it did. They're still pretty upbeat about it, or, you know, at least like, hey, we're learning, this is happening. I listened to Darren Cox on the radio, and he was saying, you know, this car's only 14 months old. The main problem, they approached the race with very cautious. It was essentially a test session for them to get the data, because they don't have 15 years of history like Audi does. They don't even know the traction control is usually mapped out with GPS in these cars. So they know the car knows where it is on the track, and it adjusts the settings accordingly. Well, they didn't even have that going in, because they haven't been here and they don't know, you know, they don't have that data for their car. That's just one of the things they're missing. So they were, you know, they considered it a test session. So they were going kind of slow, and the drivers were instructed to stay off the curbs to keep, you know, to preserve the car and make sure they finish. Even then they barely finished. Only one car made it to the end. And they had, the other thing is they had compounding issues with, the car was originally designed to be four-wheel drive. So the KERS system is based on a flywheel, and that would pour power into the rear wheels, which would give them the low speed acceleration out of corners. They don't have that this year. They're only running a single flywheel and only running it through the front wheels. It's in the 2 megajoule class, which is the lowest one. And then they didn't run KERS at the track. They were having trouble with it. I'm not sure what the reason was, but as I understood it, they were either barely using it or not using it at all. So that put extra strain on the brakes. It put a bunch of extra vibration into the front end. So they were dealing with, the brakes held up okay, but that was just like another issue they had to deal with, was all this extra heat and all this extra wear on the brakes. And the big problem, though, was they seemed to have vibration issues in two of the cars that was giving them gearbox trouble. And then, so the 23 car was their main car, and I think that's the one, in the middle of the night, it had, like, bodywork fly off of it and hit the other car. So the 22 car was the one that was running the best. That's the one that finished. And it had to come in because it got hit by the other car, basically. I mean, accidentally. And then the 21 car, which was the retro car, it lost a wheel in the middle of the night. I didn't get the full story on that because it was asleep, but... It was basically like a lot of heartache for Nissan. So on top of all that stuff that they're working through and they learned all these lessons, they're 20 seconds off the pace, which is like really, really slow. Like the comparison I heard was at the end of last year, Toyota had the fastest car, and they're like a second, maybe 2 seconds faster at Le Mans this year than they were a year ago. So they gained 2 seconds. And they were still like 3 to 4 seconds off the pace.
Do you think that's that 20-second gap? Do you think that's insurmountable for Nissan? Do you think that, you know, this is just they're barking up the wrong tree, or do you think it's something that they can eventually overcome? And I mean, you said they were running without KERS and they were running with all kinds of other issues and kind of a limited capacity. How much of that do you think is impacting that time versus, you know, just not really the car not really working?
I think if you just look at outright speed, I think they can make up a lot of it. I don't know enough about the cars or Le Mans, but you know, not hitting curbs, that's a few seconds. That's
right, easily, absolutely,
you know,
absolutely
seconds on the track.
You're not taking the optimal line.
You know, the Porsche runs 8 megajoule, which is, if you work out the math, is everyone's saying something around 1,000 horsepower extra acceleration. So, you know, they were running essentially without KERS. They're running like 600, 650 horsepower. When you have, when you can add that much power and you can get up to speed higher, that's going to make a huge difference. So, I mean, they'll make up a big part of the gap, I bet. And they had good straight line speed, so they felt validated by that. That, you know, the whole idea of the car was to have all this front end aero and just be a slipperier design. And they seem to be happy with that. But yeah, they have a lot of work to do.
But you know, you mentioned Toyota, and where the hell were they this year? Because they didn't really, they were very competitive last year, and they didn't seem to really be a blip on the radar this year.
Yeah, like I said, I think no one expected the, I mean, the Porsches, they broke the lap record for this current configuration. They were really fast. The Toyota's only hope was that the other cars would get some trouble and they could just run consistently and, you know, maybe sneak up on them. But it turned out that they just weren't fast enough. They weren't fast enough. They weren't more efficient or anything. And Toyota's an odd one because they only run two cars. Everyone else runs three. They don't have the budget. I don't think they have the budget for two. But that's kind of a hard pill to swallow. Is, you know, you go back to your board and be like, yeah, we're not competitive, even though we spent a bunch of money. They did. Their strategy almost worked in that they had, I think their one car finished sixth because the other Germans had problems, and their number one car, Anthony Davidson actually admitted this somewhat. I mean, good on him for saying it, but he said he was just pushing too hard. So I think he hit the front. One of the front corners on his car. So that was the one car was running ahead of the two car. So both of them would have finished, you know, like fifth and sixth or fourth and fifth, probably fifth and sixth. But Davidson kind of knocked it down into eighth when they had to come in for body work repair.
And that's not bad. You know, fifth and sixth or sixth place. Like that's not a terrible place to be.
Yeah, but I mean, Le Mans is really, I mean, podium is kind of a big deal, especially depending on where you're coming from. But it's really about the win or the class win. I don't know.
Yeah, I was psyched to see that, you know, like Corvette won their class. And
And that was an awesome race there because they lost their main, or not their main car, but they're basically their number one car in like a weird wreck where Magnussen just kind of lost the rear end and beat up the car enough that they had to pull it out of contention. And then, you know, like 4 hours into the race, you've got the top four cars all running within like 5 seconds of each other. They're like running in a train, basically, just frantic. And then one of the Astons like spun out trying to catch up another car. And then, you know, things settled down for a while. And then all of a sudden the Corvette and the Ferrari are in this race where they're leapfrogging each other on pit stops. You don't know if pit strategy is going to come into play. And then Ferrari puts in their good driver and they start pulling out like 25 seconds. But that was the other crazy thing was, you know, like the gap in the heat of that battle would go up to like 30 seconds. And then one of the others would reel it in. And then finally with like 2 hours to go, it just got, the Ferrari had to go in with a pit stop. With transmission trouble. They're like in the garage, engine off, just handed it over to Corvette, which was, I would have liked to see a little more battle, but I was glad to see the Corvette win again.
And it won on reliability. Like that's endurance racing right there, I guess, is the fact that it didn't break and therefore it won.
Yeah, and that's really how Porsche won too. In the P1 class, there were three Porsches that caught on fire in the GT class, but well, one in practice, two in the race. But that's how they won the overall was the Audis. Both teams had a couple mishaps, like the 17, the number one Porsche car had a drive through for like passing under yellow. They went in a little bit. The most amazing thing was the Audi that crashed into the Ferrari and just like tore off its whole front end. They were in and out of it. They replaced the whole rear body shell and the whole front clip in 3 minutes that's not total pit time, but from the minute it got to the pit stall to the minute it pulled back onto the pit lane was 3 minutes to replace all the bodywork. But whether that was the issue or not, or it was just something inherent in the design, that car and another Audi were like losing rear bodywork or it was flapping or rubbing wrong. So then the nine car, the third Audi, was having hybrid issues at the end of the race. So that was it right there, really, was the Porsches ran more reliable, which was kind of a surprise for everyone because they've had, in the first two races this season, they couldn't keep up race pace reliably and, you know, they were harder on tires and everyone just assumed that Audi had was going to be the endurance pros, but this wasn't the year for them.
Do you think that the tension between the sort of the family tension between the Audi and the Porsche is going to make that continue to be exciting?
everyone kind of says like Audi just can't keep doing this. Like what do they get out of it? They're spending like $500 million a year. They've won 13 times. You know, how long do they need to be there? So the people kind of think Audi might just get out. Or Bentley will start a team, which will essentially be Audi with more British people running it.
Yeah, I mean, Bentley makes sense. Audi, like, they don't really spin that into much that has anything to do with the road cars. So, I mean, Porsche, obviously, there's a pretty clear line. Porsche's been in motorsports since the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, if Audi could do it gracefully, you know, it would look like a downgrade. But if Audi could do it gracefully, getting into GTE would be pretty cool. Because that's going to be, you know, they have the R8. And it would, you know, I feel like that sells cars. It's so cool because they have this, they have the balance of performance, which is a little bit of shenanigans, but it makes for good racing. So, you know, they have it tuned pretty solid that any of the four cars in this year's race could have won. Ford's coming in next year.
Yeah, that was the other thing I wanted to talk about. New Ford GT.
Yeah, it looks awesome. It has this. So the Ford showed it at the race, and it was like way down. It was a hike to get there, and then it was basically like Ford Racing's hospitality suite. So it was a room that would comfortably fit 20 or 30 people, and they must have had 100 in them. But it looks. I mean, it looks like the road car. There's a couple of changes. Like it doesn't have. The center exhaust is covered. It's got this giant wing on it and this huge diffuser. So if you look at the pictures online, that's the diffuser that all the GTE cars are going to run next year. And I heard someone saying Multimatic is building the car. It's this engineering company in Ontario. They make the fancy spool valve dampers that are on the Z28 and they're on like most of the Le Mans field. They're really, really really great shocks. And, but apparently he was saying that on their simulator, the diffuser is good for like an extra 2 or 4 seconds on the track. It's going to make all of those cars even more ridiculous, which is, I think, fantastic.
That's going to be, so that next year you're going to go back to France and, hang out in the infield and tell us about the Ford effort at Le Mans.
Yeah, I mean it's a long, grueling weekend. I don't know, and I slept for part of it, so I would do it again in a heartbeat. But I don't know if I would do it every single year.
Yeah,
this year was lucky because it didn't rain during the race. It rains every part of every weekend.
Well, I mean, that's what makes it more thrilling. So that's the thing, like, too, like, Le Mans is like this, it's this outlier race, like, it's its own thing to such a large degree because it's a long race, it's on a big circuit, and the variables are so wide open. You know, you can have the weather take the car out, you can have just a mistake or mechanical problems, like, that's why it's so exciting.
Yeah, and it's always, I mean, the first, everyone runs so close now that the first, you know, it starts at 3 o'clock. So running into right up until sundown, there's usually some kind of battle going on. And like I said, you're 4 hours in and you're like, wait a minute, we're 4 hours in and nobody's opened up a gap. That's crazy. You know, they've gone through multiple pit stops and at least one driver change usually. And then, you know, like through the night is kind of a story because you have fatigue and maybe some early people falling off. And that's where the Porsche made up the gap to kind of win the race was they had one of their drivers, I'm forgetting the name right now, but one of their drivers basically just ran this incredible stint of, you know, consistently fast times. And then you get back to morning and it's like, it's almost stressful. You're just waiting. Everyone's waiting for something to happen where, you know, the mood is like, just don't screw up. And inevitably something does, like the Ferrari, you know, the Ferrari gearbox goes, or the guy that was leading GT amateur just took the car right into the tire barrier and like took off the whole, it was an hour ago. All he had to do was continue to lap. He could have lapped 5 seconds slow. And they were saying on the radio, they're thinking that like his foot slipped off the pedal or something. Cause there was like no other way. He just drove straight. He like went straight at a turn into the barrier and threw away the win. Giving Patrick Dempsey.
That's what they were saying on TV. Patrick
Dempsey is second in class.
Sorry.
Yeah, and Patrick Dempsey got second in class, which I think is pretty amazing because it kind of legitimizes him. You know, like, I think people sneer at actor drivers sometimes, and he's the real deal. He's
unless you're Steve McQueen, and then you're some sort of like hero, because
yeah, but
you know,
it is. You know, there's like a whole golf store, and like, you know, people. I think the Le Mans movie Porsche 917 is the most famous one, and it's not even a real number. Like that number 917 didn't run. As far as I know, I could be wrong. I don't know all my Le Mans history, but you know, like that's the stuff that people are, they want to buy the Steve McQueen jacket or like picture of that car. It's like,
it's the cult of personality, man.
It is. That's why, a couple years ago at Pebble, the like first, like an early prototype Ford GT sold for like $4 million and the Steve McQueen Ford GT sold for $10 million. It's like, which one of these is more significant in the history of the automobile? Oh, the Steve McQueen one, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're just like, they're kind of emptying his garage, and like, the next thing you know is his like toothbrush is going to sell for $2 million. It's just, I mean, whatever. It's fine. So there were other things that happened.
This the most celebrated domestic abuser ever.
Oh, yeah, well. I mean, we all have our demons, right?
We don't need to.
Yeah, that's a different podcast.
People remember the hero, I guess.
The actor, they remember the roles.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's hit a couple of news bite things real quick. These are kind of the way I wanted to set this up is just sort of go through them quickly and get your unvarnished reaction to them. So the first one I picked out was that Volvo has said that they're going to battle the Germans by reducing complexity. And we had a nice video from Seth showing us the touchscreen in the new XC90 and saying, Volvo has said that the German cars that they compete with, like one has 55 buttons and the other has like 37 and the XC90 has 8, which means that there's a lot of functions in the touchscreen and it's got swipe controls and those kind of things. And so I think people know where I stand, but like, is this a good thing or a bad thing or yay or nay?
I mean, I think making things easier on the driver is always a good thing. I don't know if putting an iPad in the dash is necessarily the way to do it.
Yeah. In terms of my impression of it, I watched Seth's video and I was like, that doesn't look easier. He's talking about how responsive the screen is and he's got to touch stuff twice. And like,
well, it's also like we're going to beat the Germans by reducing complexity. It's like, well, you're picking the most complex group of manufacturers out there. It's like, oh, we're just going to be slightly less. I mean, I guess that's a strategy, but I would have hoped the message would be reaching a little higher.
I mean, I will say the panel of the whole dash of the new XC90 looks very clean. I like it in terms of the way it looks. I haven't driven one yet, so I can't tell you how much I like or dislike the way it operates, but
I don't know. I wrote this story and it was kind of in the back of my head the whole time that it kind of strikes me as a cop out saying, well, we only have, you know, 8 buttons that control everything, which is, you know, kind of not true when you factor in how many buttons are replaced by the touchscreen.
Right. That's a Cadillac with Q, right? Like they got a very clean center stack. It looks really nice. Awful to use.
Sure. And I think until we really start seeing IQS scores on the new XC90, I don't think we'll be able to tell if this strategy really works. I've only messed with the system briefly at an auto show. So I can't really say too much about the learning curve on it. It's really dependent on that, like how simple they make it for drivers to live with. And I think part of that will require them to like really amp up the dealership training for when people are actually buying the cars. Like if they're actually taught in the dealer, like this is how the system works, this is why it's so much less complex. You know, then it might, their strategy might work for them.
And so just so we're clear too, like are we fans of complexity or deep technology, or are we like cars need to have manual windows and
simplifying and lightness?
To me, it's just the, you know, the experience. Like, touchscreens are generally distracting. You have to, you know, because you have to look and control your hand, right? Instead of a controller, you don't need to look at what you're. It's less of a distraction, I think, with a controller. And, you know, so it's kind of like saying we're going to make health food by being, you know, having less saturated fat than KFC. It's like we're going to be more simple than the Germans, or we have less buttons than the Germans. I don't know if I buy it. It can still be beautiful, and I haven't tried it myself. It can be beautiful, it can work well, but I'm kind of sold on the Porsche approach, where they just have a ton of buttons, and their idea is like, once you learn this and once you own it, it's kind of you know, you'll figure it out, and that's better than a touchscreen. It's kind of like an airplane cockpit.
I kind of just like the knob and dial systems. I mean, iDrive is great. It's easy to figure out. Same with MMI. I'm not a huge fan of the latest version of the Mercedes system that's actually in my CLS.
That's slightly inscrutable. Yeah.
Yeah, they made it worse. It used to be one of the best systems, and it's very, very fussy, and it's too deep now. And, you know, why do I have to go to a completely separate screen if I want to change from FM to satellite?
Yeah, like, you gotta go. It's like two steps, and that's so. My little analogy. Go ahead.
I was just saying, yeah. So in that sense, Volvo has an easy target, but they can do it. Sure.
Yeah, if they make it operate well. So I just think about how we had Gmail for Business, and so that's where all my work mail came through. It was a Gmail account, and we had Google Docs and Google Calendar and everything all integrated pretty nicely. And then we decided to go to Office 365 and SharePoint. Nothing works. And when you can figure out how to make it work, there's 7 clicks to do one thing that you would do with like one click in Google. So it's like, okay, guys, I get all the reasons why you switched to this solution. It's not better. It's worse because functionally it sucks. I don't care about anything else other than the user experience, and the user experience is bad. So I'm sure the underlying technology is not tremendously different. I'm sure the Volvos pack a lot of the same functions that the German cars do. It's just how you access them. So I'll reserve sort of final judgment, but reducing buttons can be good or it can be really bad. I'm not sure where I stand on it so far. I like dedicated buttons because I don't have to look at a screen, and the screens are too bright. So get off my lawn. And speaking of older stuff too, there's a bill to allow low volume replica cars being sold turnkey instead of having to do the silly dance now with buy the kit and then have somebody else build the kit and all of those things. So that seems like a positive change. I don't know if it really means anything. Just like we figured out ways around this, and now they're just saying, yeah, we know it's a charade. So,
it's a step in the right direction. It's kind of like saying, hey, you know, look, we're going to do this, and then it's not going to be a disaster. And then maybe we'll get some other, you know, slackening of the regulations. Like, I mean, we'll never get to coordinated crash test with Euro, but that would be the dream. We could just have
awesome, or like one gasoline across the entire country. So good. do you think that this is going to actually? So they're saying it could create jobs. Do you think that that's an actual possibility, that by clearing the way for these things to be sold turnkey, it will be better for the industry than, you know,
that's the pitch? This is going to create jobs. I mean,
yeah,
that's a pretty weak pitch. I mean,
it's the manufacturers, the individual manufacturers can produce no more than 500 vehicles per year. But part of the pitch is that, it will create skilled labor jobs in the auto industry and help meet consumer demand for these classics of the past. I didn't know that there was that much pent-up demand that's not being served. It'd be cool if it did create jobs. I'm having a hard time sort of squaring that with reality. Like,
There's I mean, that sounds like tens of jobs, right? You know, tens if you're.
Yeah. So,
it's like I said, I you know, it's anything. Anything that's recognizing, you know, car enthusiasm and engaging it from a lawmaking standpoint, I think is good. But this is also a year from 5 years from now, will anyone be like, thank God we can get all these replicas? I don't think
Or you can just buy yourself like a
bring back the Studebaker Avanti now. I've been waiting for my chance. I couldn't get enough volume to make it profitable.
Oh, the last ones were the worst. They were just based on the F body, and they had that weird '90s F body roof line, and then the Avanti sort of squared off. But yeah, all right. Enough reminiscing. Honda's working on a new mid-engine sports car that's supposed to slot below the NSX, or we're not quite sure what we're looking at, but we saw patent drawings. What do you guys think that is?
You know, it's weird. I have one of my favorite automotive patents is Ferrari has this one for like a driver coach in the car.
You have favorite automotive patents.
There are, sometimes if you go into like the internet hole that is like Google patent search, you can find some really interesting stuff.
I'm sure you can.
I mean, this is how this one was found. You just do Honda Motor Company or whatever they're listed on their patents, and then you search by most recent and you see what they've come up with. So Ferrari had one that's like, it knows what track you're on and it looks at what you're doing versus the ideal line. And it tries to encourage you like when you should brake and when you should gas. And then that ties into how much leeway with stability control gives you. So it's essentially, it's both helping you drive fast and like making a novice driver drive more proper, but also, you know, giving you more leeway as you get faster. They've never done anything. They just sort of said, hey, this is an idea. We think we could do it. We're going to make a patent on it, which is great. So this could be the same thing with Honda. It's like, hey, we're exploring possibilities and we just want to make sure we're covered on this. But when you get to a car design, that usually means more. I think, like Lamborghini will patent the basic styling and shape of their cars. And so when they file the patent, it's not a descriptive drawing, but it's enough to give them intellectual property rights. And so you know they're making that car.
Yeah. I'm looking at this going, is it a mid-engine sort of, the thing that we've heard is like, oh, it's a mid-engine with the turbo 2-liter in it, or is it something that's got the hybrid system in it instead? So I don't know, it could go kind of any way, right? Like, it's a drawing, it looks cool, that's all we know.
And I mean, I love it. I mean, I love the idea. I'm a fan of Honda sports cars. I question the global market for such a car. It's like, you know, the 2-seat sports cars are, the volume is shrinking. It's not something that buyers are clamoring for. People or automakers are trying to jump into. And also, shame on all of us for not buying more coupes. But
well, we say, you know, things like, on the internet like, if you build it, we'll buy it, and then we don't, and that's why, you know, we have things like the Chevy SS that doesn't sell, even though it's probably the most awesome thing ever.
Yeah. So I don't know what to think of it. I hope they make it for the sake of so we can put it in that list of things like the Chevy SS that was like, nobody understood it. That thing was great.
Yeah, and it's, we have no idea of scale or any of that stuff. So let's all just calm down, see what happens. I think it's cool looking.
Manufacturers patent things all the time. I mean, they patent it and they copyright it and they do all that stuff. It could be something that they just toyed around with. And that's kind of the angle that I'm leaning towards. I love the idea, and if it's anything, I think it's an NSX convertible. which as the report notes, it's the company is already, you know, allegedly working on that. It's the next logical step for that car, I think.
But the nose and the like the overall
details. Tony Stark drove it in the Avengers already.
Yes, he did. And if you look closely, that's actually the interior of like a 91 NSX that they donated. It's very plasticky and old, but back on topic. I think that's what it is. I think, you know, the drawings might be just something to keep people off the scent, kind of.
Oh, so you think that like the variation in nose shape and stuff is actually...
That's what I'd do. I mean, if you wanted to keep it secret, but still patent the overall design of your convertible sports car. You know, the part that matters, the convertible top. You've already got the patent on the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, the point of the NSX, too, is, you know, that's kind of Occam's razor there. It's like, wait a minute, they're going to build a whole new mid-engine Roadster. No, they already have a mid-engine car.
Right.
This seems to make sense.
Well, time will tell.
And if it's anything like the hardtop NSX, it'll take 20 years to come to market.
Yeah, at the end of the day. Is that one of your favorite tropes? The end of
yeah.
The, yeah. Well, at the end of the day, we still don't have the Tesla Model X, although they're saying September. I really, really want that to come, and I want it to cost $50,000. I will try to figure out how to stretch to buy one of those, because it's so the perfect electric car for family crossover drivers. But we've seen that delayed and delayed and delayed. So I don't know. I think we should start a pool, Brandon. Can we start a pool on the Model X is going to start?
You need a wide range of dates for that.
Yeah. Well, that's fine.
Speaking of pools, the Chicago Blackhawks have just won the Stanley Cup. So there's that.
No, when
I was rooting for Steve Yzerman.
As any good Detroiter was.
I have been following this. Like, I have been watching the NBA championship. I don't know why, because he's an amazing player, but I kind of like watching LeBron James lose. So,
well, back to rooting against people. Lots of people like to cheer against Elon Musk. I'm one of them sometimes, but I do have to say you got to admire Tesla for sticking to the plan, right? Because I think any other automaker would have been like, you know, we can't do these crazy, I think they call them Falcon doors on Tesla.
Yeah.
Falcon. We can't do these crazy gull wing doors. We're just going to do the same shape, but we're going to give it conventional doors. And then, you know, stuff like that happens. And then they go, oh yeah, it didn't sell. And it's like, cause you didn't make it look like the concept. And Tesla's basically saying, look, we're going to make this work. You know, so that's just the delay. Does the delay hurt more than giving up on the initial concept? I think they're in the right boat here to figure out those doors.
I mean, because they're Tesla, the delay doesn't hurt. Because they've got people lining up to buy these things. You know, they are small enough and nimble enough, and they have plenty of hubris. So they can say, nope, we're going to make the doors work. If it were Ford or GM or, you know, Volkswagen, they'd be like, yeah, that's totally impractical for mass production. And it just adds a ton of cost to the vehicle for no real benefit. Tesla's completely opposite. I mean, the benefit of the doors is just the radius that they swing in means you can get tight into parking situations and not really crack it up. Like it's a really interesting functional concept. Watching them pull it off is going to be curious, because everybody else has tried gullwing doors. They're just a nightmare. You know, you've got like the Bricklins that started the whole thing. Or I guess the Mercedes started it back in the 50s when they had the SL. But, you know, they're heavy doors, and you got to come up with some sort of like pneumatic or hydraulic actuator or some other way to move that thing up. And now we've got crash regulations. Like, how much do you think one of those doors weighs?
Well, and this is the problem. They still have to open after a side impact, you know, after a side impact, but after certain crashes, the doors still need to open. And especially in a rollover, you're rolling onto the hinge. That's what the Mercedes SLS had, like explosive hinges, so that it would, in the event of a rollover, it would basically blow the door off so you could get out.
Yeah. It's a good thing they named them Falcon Doors after the SpaceX Falcon rockets, because that seems like kind of like halfway to aerospace technology to make that stuff work. So it'll be awesome, though, when we get one to drive as a press car.
I don't think it's going to make it by September.
You don't think so?
I don't think so either.
I mean, I'd go with like maybe they'll ship a few by the end of the year, but
I mean, if I'm gambling with somebody else's money, I'm going to say they'll do September. They'll deliver one by September, I'll say. We'll see what happens.
All right. I'll take Thanksgiving then, if we're doing a pool.
Okay. All right. All right. Q&A, because we're at that point. I think we should go to some Q&A. My favorite question this week from the Q&A is, what would you rather drive, a manual that feels like crap or an automatic?
Wow.
That's such a weird...
Would you rather?
Yeah.
I guess I'd still go with the manual. It depends on the use case, though. Like, right now, I drive to work mostly on the highway, and, you know, like, manual that feels like crap is not... really doesn't give me that much over, you know, for my specific drive. But living with it every day, I still like the manual.
I feel like there are things you can do to a manual that feels like crap to make it feel less like crap. Automatic is always going to be an automatic.
Yeah, I'm kind of there.
Yeah, plus, you know, you just kind of get, there's a lot of stuff you get used to. Like, our long-term WRX just left, and it was like, I actually wrote to Steve. I was like, is something wrong with the clutch? And he's like, no, you've just been driving cars with better clutches lately. And I was like, this thing's noisy. The clutch is like heavy and feels like it's half worn down. And after like, I was driving it on a trip north for the weekend. After like 2 hours, I was like, man, I kind of like this. You get used to stuff.
I think
you get accustomed to the crappy manual.
Part of the charm. All right. So do you believe that Mark Ioanni's call for an FCA merger is just a bluff, or is it sincere? Like, is he threatening to move control over FCA out of Italy as a way to get sort of money and concessions out of Italy?
I don't think it's anything so Machiavellian, if I'm saying that word correctly.
You are.
I don't think it's anything like that. I think it's that Mark Ioanni is one of the few guys that's, you know, realized just how expensive new vehicles are to design for a global marketplace and different safety standards in different countries and all that stuff. And, you know, he's kind of recognized the realities of it, and that it makes more, that consolidation makes sense to a degree. Whether he's just saying that or if he actually believes it, I don't know. To me, it kind of makes sense. I don't really support his crazy attempts at mergers, but I gotta admit that the logic that he's using to justify it is there.
Yeah, he's not crazy. I mean, he's crazy, right? Not crazy, crazy.
I don't know. I think he's. I don't think it's a plot. You know, he wouldn't be pushing this so hard if he didn't have something to gain for it. But then my question is, why does he need it so bad? Why does he keep talking about this? Like, how bad is their ledger sheet, or like how, you know, how short are they? I think they just announced that they're going to push back the Chrysler LX, or so like the Charger and the 300. That's now like a 2018 redesign from 2017.
Yeah, well, the scuttlebutt is that that stuff has to follow the Italian brands. So because they're sharing stuff going forward, Fiat and Alfa need to roll out with their versions of that first before Chrysler.
But are Fiat and Alfa really going to roll out LX platform?
Well, maybe not LX. I mean, I forget what the first one is, but there's an Alfa that's sort of sharing a bunch with a Chrysler vehicle. And
I thought all the Alfas were just compact wide.
There was a story at Allpart. It was kind of like an editorial. It was like, well, the Alfa's got to roll out first to sort of save face, and then they can say like all this engineering was done by Alfa, and we're going to share it with Dodge or Chrysler, when it's sort of the other way around. I don't know. It's just conjecture, but
I mean, if it's applied by Marchione, it's not really working, right? It's not making any of his competitors look bad, and it's not getting someone else to jump into the deal by courting other, you know, you can't court, it's not courting one automaker to get someone else to, like, think that it's a good idea. So it confuses me.
I mean, if you're the man, right, you can look and go, oh, my career's going to wrap up. You're going to be really great. I'd like to retire with a giant vat of money.
I think he already has a giant vat of money.
Yeah. He already has a lifetime supply of blue sweaters. He doesn't need anything else.
When you get a giant vat of money, the thing that you want is more bigger giant vat of money. And I don't know. It just, the part of me goes, okay, so I can merge this company, I can make out well, and then it's off my hands. And, you know, any other manufacturer that's going to merge with them, there's going to be so much overlap that they're just going to have to kill product and plants and jobs. And so he doesn't want that blood on his hands. But no, I set them up for the future. If whatever they do, you know, he's sort of the wash his hands of the thing. He's Pontius Pilate in that situation. I don't know. I mean, it's just it's kind of a theory. I have no idea really what his strategy is.
I mean, another thing to look at is it could just be cyclical business, right? You know, like everyone went on like merger and takeover frenzies in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then we had, you know, then that didn't really work out. And then everyone spun everything off. And then we had a financial crisis. And now we're at this huge volume and the auto market's healthy and the automakers are looking at new ways to make money. And maybe they're just going back to, oh, yeah, we just need to acquire stuff again.
Yeah, that's not going to last. I can definitely say that it's a cyclical business, and eventually the bomb's going to drop out. I mean, everybody talks about how great the 50s were for automakers, and they were up until like 1958 when there was a recession that sort of clamped everything down. So that kind of stuff can happen even in boom times. You just get a bad year. So
I just kind of hope that Fiat Chrysler merger with the likely partner of PSA Peugeot Citroen brings a certain little cactus to the United States.
All right, so Brandon, actually,
I think that'd be a good move for PSA, to be entirely honest, if it gets some access back to the United States.
They tied up with Nissan. Oh, no, that's Renault.
No, that's Renault.
Peugeot and Citroen don't have the best reputations here.
Neither does Fiat or Alfa Romeo.
Yeah, and notice how well they're selling too. Like the 500 it's a curiosity. It's, I don't know. We're not going to do any better than the rest of the internet. So let's just move on to another question. Which is the best hybrid car to drive? Best miles per gallon and money saving in gas. Also, is there going to be a new generation of Toyota Prius soon?
Yes to that last question, and fairly soon, I believe.
I hope so. That is not the best hybrid car to buy. Well,
no.
Depends on what your goals are.
I think in the next couple of years, we'll see a new Prius.
The rumor with the Prius is 60 miles per gallon, a lithium ion version and a lead acid version. So you'll pay more for the more advanced battery pack, and that one might, I think that one either just has like plug-in for no weight penalty or the higher MPG. I don't remember
they just trademarked a name too, like Prius Platinum
Plus or Max or
so it's coming, but you know, it's all rumor at this point.
Best hybrid car to drive or to buy.
I know, right? I really enjoyed the...
See, here's the thing. A 7 Series active hybrid is great, I'm sure.
Come on. That's... I don't know.
If I were buying it, if it were my money right now, I would be getting a second generation Volt. I have not driven it yet, obviously, but I've always been a fan of the first generation car. I've said it on the podcast before. So that for me, that's the best option.
That's a good answer. I like that a lot. I was thinking more conventional hybrid, and that one I'd say like either Accord or Fusion. I think both of those drive really well.
I'd
second that too. Yeah,
the Fusion.
If we were talking traditional, whatever the difference is, I don't, series, parallel, I don't remember off the top of my head, but non-plug-in hybrid.
The Volt is a series hybrid.
Yes, so the opposite of that.
Right.
I think that's the parallel hybrid.
Yeah.
So, we're professionals, people.
Yeah, so, but here's the thing, right? Either way, you're buying a new automobile that has to have all the raw materials mined for it, and now you have a battery that's full of things like lithium and nickel and cadmium.
Bad stuff.
There's very few mines. You think oil is bad? There's very few mines that produce those things, and then the rare earth magnets in the motors that make them light and powerful. Again, very limited supply of those. You know who's cornering the rare earth mineral market? China. So then you've got all the energy input to smelt the ore and stamp the panels and the oil that makes the plastics and all these things and the wire, which is copper.
A lot of this is true for any new car.
It is, and that's the fallacy that you're going to save the planet by buying a hybrid. Damn it, just don't drive. You know, like, telecommute if you can, or plan your trips, or like, I really don't see any difference if you've got a car that, even let's say the average car that's 5 years old or whatever, right, and it gets 25 miles per gallon combined the way you drive it, and you drive, I don't know, the average commute is what, 30 something miles a day round trip, just try not to drive as much. That's the easiest, quickest way to save money, is just don't drive as much and don't buy a new thing to try to save the planet.
That wasn't the question,
though. No, I know. It's just me going off on my soapbox. I'm sorry. I'm done now. I feel better. I hope everybody else feels better, too. Do we feel better?
I feel better that you feel better. Are you?
I'm good. I think we should end the podcast now, because it's just not going to get any better than that. I'm done.
I got nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so let's wrap it up, because we have put podcast 435, I think, in the can. So Mike Austin and Brandon Turkus, thanks for joining. Mike, when did you come back from Lamar?
I landed at 1:30.
Yeah, so you should probably go sleep it off.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So yeah, guys, thanks for joining, and we'll catch everybody again next week. You can subscribe to the Autoblog Podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.